Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I love ringing someone's doorbell for the first time. You never know what's going to happen.
Aren't you wonderful? You're on time.
On this occasion, I've gone to Mount Vernon, Washington to interview the very charming Graham Kerr. Right after we introduced ourselves, I asked something I often ask when I'm getting to know someone.
A little tour? I'd love to. Okay.
It's a wonderful way to ease into a person's world.
This we call the little arc on the hill.
In Kerr's house, the themes immediately became clear. Sailing, food, and most of all, his wife, Trina.
This is my bedroom.
Kerr pointed out a flower box in his bedroom window. It's the first thing he sees every day when he wakes up.
Those are blue pansies outside there because my wife, Trina, when she was 10, gave me a pansy, a blue pansy in a book. And she told me that if I gave it back to her, she'd never go to the movies with another boy for the rest of her life.
This really touched me. It's not a detail that made it into the final edit, which you're going to hear in a minute, but it says so much about who he is. By showing me these pansies, Graham Kerr was telling me something deep and true. He loved his wife. This is what I love about my job. I have the enormous privilege of ringing the doorbell, walking into someone's life, and in a short amount of time, learning about the most meaningful parts of who they are. Now, this is not because I'm some fabulous interviewer. Most of my job is just shutting up. I actually think it's about you. The people that I talk to share their stories with me because they know that I'll share them with you. People just want to be known, to be heard. And I don't want to be too presumptuous here, but I think you want to listen. So, all this hour, I'm introducing you to a few of your wonderful neighbors from here in the Great Pacific Northwest. They're all here, ready to meet you, and I promise you'll be happy you got to know them. Think of it like a really great party. I'm your host, Posey Gruner. And this is Sound Effect. Now, let's go meet Graham Kerr. If you remember The Galloping Gourmet, that TV cooking show from the 70s, you probably remember how he'd run through the studio and then leap over a chair. It was his signature move. He was named after it. But the idea for that move actually came from his wife, Trina.
Let's have you jumping over a chair. And let's have you carrying a glass of wine. And he said, it's got to go everywhere. We'll fix it. So we put saran wrap over the top of it.
Trina was Kerr's producer. She won 2 Emmys for her work on the show. But just beneath the surface, there was a lot going on. It's a complicated love story, as told to me by Graham Kerr.
This is the two of us when we were 70, with our fingers all interlaced, which we like to do. This was on our boat.
They met when they were kids in 1945, and he fell for her at a strawberries and cream badminton party.
I took a wild swipe at a shuttlecock, and it went into a huge rhododendron bush, and it got lost. And so Trina and I went diving into this tree. We did eventually find it, but our hands touched in that cool English afternoon, all dressed in white, you know, with strawberries and cream. It doesn't get more British than that, does it? But when our hands touched, I really knew then that this pretty little girl was a girl.
He fell hard. But then Trina moved away. A decade passed.
And then, I was in the army and I was in bed with rubella. I was reading a tabloid, And there opened the page, and there was Trina.
Pretty young Trina Van Dorn won the proud title Miss Jersey Battle of Flowers this year.
Trina had won a beauty pageant in the Channel Islands, and she was having great success in the local theater. Graham very much wanted to be in touch.
I wrote to the Daily Mirror and said, this is my first girlfriend. Can you book me? And they did.
They corresponded, and Trina agreed to meet. The moment he saw her, he fell for her all over again. But he didn't know how she felt.
I took Trina for a walk the next morning, and we came to a cattle crossing, and it was very muddy and wet. And I said, very graciously, can I carry you across this? It looks a bit muddy and stuff. And she said, well, okay. So I swept her up in my arms. That was the first time I got a hold of her. And strode out across this cattle crossing and went up to my knee in a mixture of mud and manure, just unable to take another step. And so I'm holding on tight, and her face is very close to mine. And she said, so what do we do now? And I said, well, would you marry me? And she said, of course, you know, and we kissed for the first time right there.
Even though she'd agreed to marry him, he had one more request.
And I said, well, you know, if you go on with the theater like you're capable of doing and become a movie star, I don't think I've got what it takes.
Graham admits that this sounds very out of date, but this was the 1950s, and he felt he couldn't handle being married to a woman who lived for her audience.
So I'm going to have to ask you, if we're going to marry, could you give it up? And she looked at me and she said, of course. It's the same word that she said when I asked her to marry her. So, that brings tears to my eyes.
They married soon after. Within a year, they had their first child. A few years later, Kerr was recruited into the New Zealand Air Force, where he became the chief catering advisor. And that's how, by chance, he ended up on one of the country's very first TV programs.
The Air Force were asked whether they would provide an officer to do something on television when it started. So I went under orders, and I cooked an omelette, and it was written up as the best live show to date, which was not hard, because it was so new. There was only 50 television sets in the whole country at that stage. Anyway, that morphed into having my own show. And I was placed between Peyton Place and the Avengers. And Trina's watching me do a program, and she screams. She said, you are the most unutterably boring man in the entire world, and you need to do something about it. I said, okay, so you're so clever. Why don't you produce the show? All right, I will.
She took charge of production right away. Everything she knew intuitively, Graham says, she poured into him, and it worked. The New Zealand show was successful. Then, Kerr made a second show in Australia, and that was a hit. Graham was a star. Meanwhile, back in New Zealand, Trina's star was also rising.
She now had been given the lead role in Oh, What a Lovely War. And I was really nervous about that because it seemed like here was the grease paint again and here was the roar of the cloud, and she was delighted and delightful in the part. And for me, it was, I had...
He couldn't handle it.
So I let her down and was unfaithful, stupid. When you love somebody as much as I love Trina, to fail them so absolutely, just because you think that they may be getting back into something that you can't handle, is so damn self-serving. And anyway, so long and short of it is, she finds out about this, and I'm asking forgiveness, and she can't do that.
Still, they had children, a marriage, and a career to manage.
So we then enter into 9 incredible years in which she is doing everything she can to help me to be successful, except being able to love me and forgive me.
These were the years at the height of Kerr's fame. After his success in Australia, they leapt into Canada. And there, Trina produced his most famous show, The Galloping Gourmet. On TV, they looked like a wonderful couple who were living out the best years of their lives. Graham Kerr was famous. Trina Kerr was nominated for 2 Emmys for her work on the show. But their relationship was broken. Graham had once feared being cast in the shadow of Trina's fame. But in the end, it was Trina who got lost. Trina wrote a poem about it. Later in life, she recorded it and set it to music.
Shadows are different. They seldom are warm. Some are quite chilly, unpleasant, forlorn. Especially when shadows come from the fame of one who is known to the public by name.
The years passed. The show ended. Trina had a cancer scare. She had surgery and she was in pain.
So she was given opioids. Hello. More opioids from the local doctors, more Mogadon to help her go to sleep, Benzedrine to get her up in the morning. And then because there was an underlying issue of unforgiveness, that was hurting perhaps more than anything. And for that, it was antidepressants.
By the mid-70s, Trina was having serious mood swings.
And she would scream and her eyes would fill with blood and her pretty little mouth would get foamy. It was really scary and awful. And I went to her and I said, you know, I do think that your inability to forgive me and for what I did now 9 years ago is really the source of the major difficulty you're having in your life. And therefore, I think I need to get out of your life. I love you, but I don't think you need me. She went upstairs and said she'd think about it, came down and gave me a poem.
One is half if left or leaves the arms of one whose life is stressed.
The poem ends, I prefer to
be complete and walk with you along the street toward the other half of itself, to learn with you, to help, to understand the way we lost ourselves. We have the right to right the wrongs to each we've made.
No one alone is wrong.
No one alone is right.
And no one alone
in marriage,
is right.
We are
but
one.
Love is ours.
And love is not ours.
Flight.
Not flight.
Still touches me the way that it did at the time. I realized that this was not over. I didn't know how we would get to unforgiveness, but I knew that it was possible.
A month later, their life took a sharp turn. A maid they employed had been praying for Trina. In fact, her whole church had been praying for Trina for 3 whole months.
And in the last month, they'd been fasting and praying 24 hours a day.
One day, that maid came to Trina with a suggestion.
Mrs. Kerr, why don't you give your problems to God? And Trina said, all right, God, if you're so bloody clever, you deal with me because I can't.
So Trina went to get baptized, just to see if it would do some good. And then something unexpected happened.
She catches a vision of a man standing gloriously, radiantly in front of her, who smiles at her in a really, really accepting way, reaches out and touches her heart. And she went back that night and she took every pill she had and she put them right down the drain. And every physician I've spoken to said, you just can't do that. She would have gone into a coma. And she didn't. She had a great night's sleep, got out of bed the next day, and she just shouted out, I've got it. Whatever you get when I did what I did yesterday, I've got it.
Graham had no idea. He had been away on a trip, and he came home 5 days later.
Dropped my bag at the door, which I normally did, and she walked towards me peacefully. And she put her arms around my neck. And she put her cheek against mine. Just held me. She didn't say, I forgive you. she just did. I am a grateful man.
That was the beginning of more than 30 wonderful years together. Trina brought Graham to Christianity, too. Over time, Graham appeared in public less and less, and his star began to dim. But, Graham says, Trina's never did. Even on a private stage, she was as luminous as ever.
Everybody who met us seemed to gravitate to her. I know it sounds odd, but I became the sort of the background for her.
Trina died in 2015, just 5 days before their 60th wedding anniversary. Sometimes he imagines how she must look in heaven. He thinks it might be something like the way she looks in a favorite photo. In this picture, Trina is swimming.
And as you can see, she's got a big smile on her face and she's so free. And I feel this is her now, in this kind of freedom.
He keeps the photo just outside his kitchen, where he can see her every day until they meet again. Coming up, we meet a woman who is lifting the stigma from mental illness, one gravestone at a time. Plus, a rabbi and a rapper collaborate to tell a secret history. That's all ahead on Sound Effect from KNKX. This is Sound Effect. I'm Posey Gruner, and this week I'm sharing some of my favorite origins stories with you. Stories about people in our region and the people, places, or things that made them who they are. This next story is about a place, a historic cemetery outside Western State Hospital. The people buried there died while being treated for mental illness, and for decades, their graves were marked with nothing but a number. This story is also about a woman, Laurel Lemke. Nearly 20 years ago, Lemke made it her mission to install markers with names and dates above each grave in this cemetery. She's not done yet. The story begins at Laurel's home in Lakewood, Washington.
When we started out,
Laurel Lemke unrolls a paper map onto her kitchen table.
This is all we had.
It shows the location of thousands of graves.
And you'll notice that the markers are all just numbers.
The first burial in this cemetery was in 1876.
The lowest numbers we have are 17, 18, 19, 20.
Back then, it was the cemetery for the insane asylum of Washington Territory.
7, 28, 29,
the last burial was in 1953, when the hospital was known simply as Western State Hospital.
2750.
More than 3,000 people are buried there. Above each grave is a small, flat stone carved with a number.
2755.
There has always been a record of who was buried under which number, but that record was sealed.
2760. So it doesn't mean much, doesn't these numbers, but then to put the real names in there meant so much.
Taking these numbers and turning them into names has been Lemke's passion for nearly 20 years. It all started around the year 2000. At that time, Lemke was working at Western State Hospital, and someone got in touch with her because they wanted to hold a memorial at the cemetery. The event was a success, but one thing bugged Lemke. The grave markers were all sunken into the ground, covered over by grass, barely even visible.
We thought maybe, you know, that the markers had disintegrated, but they were all under the ground.
Lemke wanted to do something about it. So she organized a group of people, and they brought the numbered stones back to level ground, where people could see them. That was the beginning. Today, 20 years later, Lemke is the chairwoman of a volunteer organization called the Grave Concerns Association. The association has just one purpose: to install headstones with names in this cemetery. It's a tangible way to do something symbolic, to lift the stigma from mental illness. Lemke is passionate about this because she knows what mental illness is like.
I had my life interrupted several times.
It started in college. She would have symptoms of mania and then experience a long depression. It would go away and then come back. But Lemke feels lucky, luckier than most of the people buried here.
When I first had my symptoms, it was in the 70s. medications and treatments were available. I didn't have to go to state hospital. I didn't have a fate like this. I was able to have a productive career.
Lemke ended up working in the field of mental health as an advocate for people with mental illnesses. She's retired now, but she still tends to the cemetery.
And where we're going to be going today, where our big markers are right here.
The big markers, as Lemke calls them, are places where hundreds of cans of cremated remains are buried in a single grave. The marker she points out, number 2695, is the final resting place for about 500 people. Today, they're going to place a headstone above can number 331. To get to the cemetery, Lemke drives a few minutes down the road from her house, turns left at Western State Hospital, and enters Fort Steilacoom Park. This land used to be the hospital's farm. Now there are soccer fields and a dog park, and a little cemetery surrounded by a fence. The weather is blustery and wet. A small crowd stands in the corner of the cemetery, squinting into the wind. One of them is dressed appropriately for the day, with duck boots, a cap, and some work gloves. This is Jim Elvis, and he's here to lay the headstone.
It's nice to be here trying to accomplish something positive.
Elvis is a genealogist, and he'd run into a problem when he was making a family tree for his cousin. He couldn't find her grandmother's grave.
This is the death certificate I got. But you can see they don't mention the place of burial. They just put cremation.
Elvis had wanted to give his cousin a picture of her grandmother's grave, and that's usually pretty easy. Just go to findagrave.com and type in her name. But in this case, Elvis had to look a little harder. Finally, he came across the Grave Concerns website.
It was number grave number 2695 and can number 331. Yeah, her name.
So he'd found a name and a number, but no headstone to take a picture of.
I'm sure they didn't mean anything negative by handling it the way they did. I mean, back then it was a stigma and people were ashamed to be associated with them.
So, quick story here. The fact that Elvis found anything on that database at all, that's also due to Grave Concerns. The stigma that kept her name off the headstone also kept her name off publicly accessible records. And before they could do anything in this cemetery, first they had to change that. There were barriers to changing it. Concerns about medical privacy, like HIPAA laws. Concerns that families might not want it to be public knowledge that their ancestors were buried outside a mental hospital.
I can tell you there was someone known in our state history, prominent name, that had a family member at the hospital. And that was never discussed. Their family member was there at the hospital.
So there were hurdles. But one Grave Concerns volunteer, Sherry Storms, was determined to give these people more than just a number.
She kept saying, I want the names. I want to have the names. And I kept saying, it's a law. We can't give you the names.
Finally, they decided to see what it would take to change that. They weren't lawyers, but they figured it out. They rewrote the relevant bit of state code and lobbied to get the changes made into law. And then, in 2004, they passed Senate Bill 6678. It totally changed Lemke's idea about what's possible.
So a lot of times people say, you can't do that, it's against the law. I always say, well, we can change the law.
As for installing the headstones, they've gone slowly. They rely on private donations, a team of volunteers, and the occasional manual labor from a genealogist.
It's already got a little mark there.
Elvis digs a shallow hole out of the turf, the same size and shape as the marker. They're leaving the original grave number as is, but they're adding a headstone, one with her name and her lifespan.
Corners are the most important.
Yeah, I would think.
For Elvis, this is the last step in his research into his cousin's grandmother. He didn't know her at all before he started, but he feels like he's gotten to know her a little bit.
When I research a person, they sort of become alive. Once you know where they live, who they were married to, and their kids, you start to get sort of an impression of them.
He learned that she was born in 1897. She got married when she was 20 years old. She had 5 kids. In 1936, she was admitted to Western State Hospital. The doctors listed her diagnosis as dementia praecox. That's an old diagnosis for what today is usually called schizophrenia. She died 3 years later.
I think that's
deep enough.
Elvis wrestles the stone into the spot.
Okay, that's good. Okay, yeah, so just a little bit of dirt in.
When it's in place, he reads the headstone aloud.
It says, Ruby Violet Knight, 1897 to 1939.
Ruby Violet Knight. Elvis lays a wreath on her grave.
It reflects on ourselves. I think people that tend to degrade people are degraded themselves. And maybe if we look upon people as somebody of worth instead of cans in the number, that somehow gives us a sense of worth too.
Usually at this point, someone from Grave Concerns would stand and read a poem. They often read The Dash by Linda Ellis. But not today. It's too wet and windy. So they move on to the next part of the ritual.
Hi.
How are you?
Yes, I'm good today.
Over time, Lemke has learned how important it is to gather afterward.
We just put a marker in the cemetery.
Did you really?
It's like the wake after the funeral, partly for the dead, but mostly for the living. By reaffirming the value of the people buried here, they reaffirm the value of all life.
I mean, our whole thing is about restoring dignity, and it's an important thing to do.
The work is far from complete. There are more than 1,000 graves to go. But for today, at least, this small group of people has helped restore dignity to one person, Ruby Violet Knight, 1897 to 1939. This next story is one that I helped bring to the show, but you won't hear my voice in it. I was the editor, which means that I brought in an outside producer with a great story to tell and helped her make it sing. It's about a rabbi who felt compelled to tell the history of the Sephardic diaspora, the Jews who were expelled from Spain 500 years ago. Sephardic history is full of suffering and displacement and resilience. Problem is, that history was mostly recorded in Ladino, a language that is all but extinct. This rabbi decided it was time to give the story an update for a new audience. Contributor Sam Leeds has the story.
Rabbi Simon Benzaken is sitting at the foot of a long wooden table at a Jewish congregation in Seattle's Seward Park neighborhood. He's thumbing through a stack of papers.
Yeah, my name is Rabbi Simon Benzaken. Most of my life I've been serving as a pulpit rabbi.
Rabbi Benzaken was born in Spanish Morocco. He crossed an ocean and a continent to end up here in Seattle as the rabbi for the Jewish congregation Bikur Halim. He's in his 70s and retired now, but he's still an emeritus rabbi, and he hasn't really stopped working. Those papers he's sifting through are part of his plan to stop a language from dying and to keep the history of the people who speak it from being lost. That song he's singing, it's more than 500 years old. It sounds a lot like Spanish, right? Well, almost. Rabbi Benzaken is singing in Ladino.
Ladino is Judeo-Espanol. That is the Spanish that the Jews spoke, especially at home, spoke, and among themselves in business, so on, for hundreds of years.
Specifically, it's the language of the Jewish people who lived on the Iberian Peninsula more than 500 years ago. To get from 15th century Spain to present-day Seattle, there's more than a little bit of history. But the short version is this. In 1492, the same year that Columbus set sail from Spain, the Spanish monarchy made a decree. It said all the Jews in Spain had to convert to Christianity or leave the country. They had 4 months to choose. Many fled across the Mediterranean into the Ottoman Empire. That's the Balkans, Turkey, the Middle East, and North Africa today. Others scattered across parts of Europe. They took Ladino with them, passing it down through 5 centuries of generations across empires and continents. And the language expanded, picking up words as it went.
So you find that Ladino has got sometimes Arabic, a little bit, sometimes Turkish, sometimes a bit of French too.
Now, 500 years later, Ladino is spoken in more than 30 countries. It's a language of the diaspora. It's also a dying language. It's mostly spoken by elders in the Sephardic community. Which brings us to Rabbi Bensikon and those papers. They're written in English, Hebrew, and Ladino. They're the lyrics to ancient love songs. And Rabbi Bensikon believes they are the key to reviving the Ladino language. Even more importantly, they hold the answer to a question he's asked himself quite a bit. Why isn't there more written about the Sephardic diaspora?
Didn't they care what happened to them, that they decided not to write their history? To me, it's almost like we don't care about our history.
But he knew that couldn't be true.
They did write, and they wanted to write. The only thing is they could not write. Why?
He has a theory.
They were afraid for themselves. If they were to criticize Spain, they would be in the fire again.
Remember that song Rabbi Bensikon was singing? It's called a romanza, and Rabbi Bensikon thinks it has a hidden meaning.
Many times they sound like grandmother is singing, you know, without even thinking, what is it? Lullabies and so on, but it's much more into this Ladino romanza.
The songs sound like simple love songs, but they're actually just a lot of complaining.
Why did you trick me? Why did you cheat me? Why did you make me suffer? And you don't deserve me, and so on.
Rabbi Bensikon thinks these romances aren't really about love at all.
This was a dialogue between the Jews of Spain, from Spain as they were, being expelled and remembering what they had to go through.
There's one song in particular that first got him thinking about this coded meaning.
Torno y dijo, que va ser de mí? Que va ser de mí? What's going to happen to me? What's going to be of me? What's going to happen to me? En tierras ajenas me voy a morir. I'm going to die in foreign lands. Blanca viste, blanca. And they were saying, you Spain, you know what you did to me now. By expelling all of us, you are now throwing us to the wind, to death.
He used to feel ashamed that his ancestors hadn't told their stories. Now that he's found this hidden meaning, that shame is gone. These songs make him proud of his heritage. But he knows that most people won't really take the time to listen to Grandma's love songs. And if they do, they'll probably miss the deep pain tucked away inside the words. So to bring these songs new life, he's giving them a more modern sound, one that has its own history of pain and diaspora.
Como judío sefardí, me creí toda mi vida que mi amor y dependencia era en ti.
Yes, the emeritus rabbi writes rap, but he doesn't do it alone.
Yeah, my name is Alexander, or Alex Hernandez.
Alex is a rapper from northern Mexico. He and his wife, Nesak, moved to Seattle to find a Sephardic community.
Where I'm from, you don't see any Jewish communities. You see a lot of people that are Jewish descendants. I myself think that I'm Jewish, from Jewish descendants. So is my wife.
Alex believes his family forgot their Sephardic history long before he was born. Because of the forced conversions 500 years ago, many Sephardic families lost their Jewish heritage. Generations grew up believing they were Christians who had some unusual traditions, such as lighting candles just before sunset on Fridays. Nesak remembers her grandmother singing to her in Ladino when she was a little girl. At Bikur Halem, she heard Ladino again for the first time in years. She suggested Alex partner with Rabbi Bensikon. It was a perfect match. Rabbi Bensikon brings the singing and Alex the hip-hop lyricism.
I'm like, you know what, Rabbi, probably if we try to shorten a little bit the lyrics, because otherwise it's going to be like very fast, and probably people won't be able to understand it.
With Nesak producing, Alex and Rabbi Bensikon formed Los Serenos Sefarad, the Sephardic Watchmen. Their first show was a live performance in Seward Park. Since then, they've filmed several music videos and released a full-length album in 2017. For Alex, it's not just about making music. He feels a duty to share the history of the people who came before him, who passed on their stories and kept their language alive.
We are the voice that many hundred years later are able to communicate what they couldn't.
About a year ago, Alex and Netzach decided they wanted an even bigger Jewish community. So they made Aliyah and moved to Israel. Rabbi Benzaken visited them there. So, of course, Los Serenos had a concert in Jerusalem, too. It was an enthusiastic crowd. People stuck around after the music ended.
After the concert, everyone was coming up to say hi to us and give a pretty good feedback about the songs.
And then something happened that felt too coincidental not to be a sign. That maybe, in bringing together rap and 500-year-old ballads, they were finding a way to make Ladino the language of the young people.
Two teenagers that came to say hi to us, and actually they were from Seattle, both of them.
It was a small indication, but it felt right.
That story came to us from contributor Sam Leeds. Coming up, I share my own origin story. It's about Jesus and marijuana and how I almost didn't have a birthday. That's coming up on Sound Effect. Don't go away. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm producer Posey Gruner, and today I've been sharing origin stories of people all around the Puget Sound. I thought it was only fair to end the hour with my own origin story, and it's a pretty literal one, about the day that I was born. See, I was born into the Love family, a commune, some call it a cult, that existed in Seattle in the 70s and 80s. This is the story of how a cult took my birthday and how one woman got it back. The day I was born, my parents were living in the now. My father was looking out the window, noticing how the morning sun made the fresh snow sparkle. My mother was focusing on the pain. But they weren't just living in the moment. They were in the eternal now. Their names were Constance and Richness, and they lived with their brothers and sisters on the top of Queen Anne Hill in Seattle. They had a council of elders, and they had a patriarch, a man named Love Israel.
They're called the Love family. 300 to 400 strong, they live communally and share the same last name. That name is Israel.
People in the family had long hair and beards. They wore handmade dresses and flowing robes. They smelled of body odor and brown rice and marijuana. They had drums and guitars, and they liked to sing. Love had brought these people together, and he had arranged their life according to a few key principles. We are all one. Love is the answer. The time is now. That time is now stuff, they took that one to an extreme. People in the family didn't keep track of days or months or even years. Time just didn't apply to them. And so they didn't apply it to their kids either.
Because the family believes that human beings are eternal and therefore have no ages, the children don't celebrate birthdays. They don't even know how old they are.
And that's how it happened that on the day I was born, my parents had no idea what day it was. But there was another person in the room that day.
This is my writing. Let's see if we got Posey on here.
This is J.L. Regis.
Relief,
she's better. The midwife who delivered me.
Brotherhood, right.
We're at her kitchen table, flipping through the handwritten pages of a ledger.
I scribbled dates down on this.
She traces a finger down row after row of meticulous handwriting.
God, there's so many babies. Look at all those. Oh, yeah. That's all the way to 80. November. Oh, look, 12-2-80. There's me.
Look at that.
It's right there in ink. A month, a day, a year, a birthday, my birthday. This piece of paper would be so important to kids like me. But at the time that JL wrote it, it was heresy. To understand why this notebook was so important, we have to back up a little bit to a time before JL joined the Love family. Back then, she was a young nurse working at a doctor's office. She lived on a little farm outside Seattle, and for a while, she had been seeking friends who were on her wavelength. Then one day, a woman walked into the doctor's office.
And she was very pregnant, and she said, "Do you know anyone who does home births?" And I very quietly raised my hand.
JL delivered her baby. As a thank you, the woman suggested a few elders go to visit JL and find out if she was interested in joining the family.
The fellows who came to visit were imagination, serious, encouragement, and meekness. And they are just fine brothers.
Something about them felt right. So JL quit her job, turned over her farm and all her possessions to the family, and took up residence at the landing pad for newbies, the Front Door Inn. So JL had joined the Love family for the brothers and the sisters. And then one day, she met the father.
I can remember opening the door of the front door in, and this man standing there with this big smile on his face, thinking that I'd know who he was or, you know, something. And I'm going, "Who are you?"
Things were off to a rocky start, and they didn't much improve. For example, when people joined the family, Love would ask them to write a letter to their parents, basically saying, "Thanks for raising me, but I have a new family now." When Love asked JL to write to her mother, she said no. And she added one more thing.
"If you insist that I do, I'll probably put a P.S. at the bottom and let her know that I was told to do this."
And then there was the thing about her name. Usually, people who joined the Love family would eventually earn a virtue name. It was a sign that Love had recognized you. It was Love who named my parents Constance and Richness. And even though I was just a baby, he saw virtue in me, too. He named me Composure. But JL stayed JL.
I was not in line to get a virtue name, ever. It was not going to happen.
Love and JL were just operating on different planes. Love, of course, thought his was higher.
One time Love just said, "You are just too physical, JL. You need to be more spiritual."
But JL knew the importance of earthly concerns. Family members would slice their hands open and JL would stitch them up. People would get cavities and she'd get them to a dentist. People would get hungry and wet and cold, and she'd take it to the only guy who could do anything about it. The guy who wasn't paying much attention to that kind of stuff.
I would go to Love and say, "The kids at the ranch need eggs and milk and boots, you know, period."
Still, Love tolerated JL. And anyway, kicking her out of the family would have been a bad idea. Because JL could deliver babies. And the family was having a baby boom.
I stopped counting births at like 186 or something in my birth career.
Of course, JL was doing more than just counting these births. She was writing them down.
I had a three-ring binder. Oh my God, I loved my three-ring binder and my pencil.
After she delivered a baby, she'd pull out her binder and write down the parents' names, the baby's name, the location, and the date. And then she'd hide it away again. So all the while that Love was telling people they were eternal, JL was acting on what she knew to be true. Lives end, and lives begin, and kids grow up. She knew that there might come a day when these children would grow up and take a look around and decide that they wanted to join regular American society. And she knew that those kids would need an entry ticket. a birth certificate. That's when she got a helpful tip from a friend named Wisdom.
She used to work down at King County Courthouse, and she said, you know, you could probably just go down there and record the births. You don't have to get a birth certificate. It's not going to cost you anything. All you need is bus fare to go down.
So that's what she did. Every once in a while, Jael would scrounge up bus fare and take her notebook down to the King County Courthouse. There, she'd transfer her notes into the official record. Or kind of official.
You know, logic and simplicity was the mother of purity, you know, the parents of purity and liberty and positivity. But, you know, I just did it.
Then she'd go back and deliver more babies. Eventually, Jael's ledger was full of birth records, written by hand in her neat black pen. And then one day, love got his hands on it.
Thrown in the fire, in the fireplace.
When she realized what had happened, Jael knew she had to recreate it immediately. She and Wisdom got a new pen and new paper and rebuilt it from memory.
I remember being in Logic's basement and writing as fast as we could to put it all together again.
And that is the notebook that Jael still has to this day. My parents left the Love family when I was a toddler. Things with Love had changed for the worse. He'd developed a cocaine addiction and he was buying airplanes. Meanwhile, kids didn't have shoes. So a group of family members wrote him a letter asking him to start sharing some power. Love took one look at the letter and ripped it up. And so that's how the family fell apart. The people who had gathered together on the hill when they were just kids now came down the hill with kids of their own in tow. My parents cut their hair and started wearing street clothes. They went back to the names they were born with, Daniel and Judy. But I was still Composure. I needed a new name. So they went to the courthouse. It was 2 years too late, but they managed to get me a birth certificate. It had my name on it, Posey Gruner. And it had my birth date, the one Jael wrote down in her ledger, December 2nd, 1980. If you'd like to hear more about the Love family, look into the podcast Family Ghosts. I worked with them on a 3-episode series, and that's where you can learn much, much more about the family. You can find a link on our website at knkx.org. That'll wrap up the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and by me, Posey Gruner. Our regular host and senior producer is Gabriel Spitzer. We had help this week from Sam Leeds, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Plo. Max Wasserman is our intern, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. You can find our podcast in all the usual places. We're on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, etc. Next week, Gabriel Spitzer is back in the host chair. He'll be sharing a few of his own favorite stories. And I want to extend a special thanks this week to Gabe. He taught me everything I know about speaking into a mic, especially and repeatedly not to talk too fast.
Because otherwise it's going to be like...
I'm Posey Gruner, and this is KNKX.